Michigan HockeyCast 5.23, where we're enjoying a week with no games, just previews and news. Alex, I think we may have a debate on our hands here. What is worse, Big Ten college hockey reffing or women's basketball national championship game reffing?
It's probably pretty close.
It's bad when it's in the same ballpark, isn't it? Like, did you ever think that we were going to see something that was like comparable to what we've sort of been watching in reffing in the Big Ten and college hockey this year?
No, I mean, I think that my general takeaway from that is that women's college basketball is going to have to do the thing that you do when you become
relevant,
a league with a lot of money involved,
yeah,
which is that you have to straighten out the refereeing a lot of times. Like, that's the biggest reason college hockey refereeing is so bad, is they don't take in any money. No one cares.
Nobody cares.
Yeah.
So you're just like, all right, just throw some dudes out there and let them put them in jeans.
They're getting huge ratings for that Final Four in the national championship game. Very good to see.
Yeah, did you watch it?
Yeah.
All three games?
I didn't watch the first semifinal. I watched the Iowa-South Carolina game, then I watched the championship. I didn't watch the LSU one. But no, it was very compelling games, big-time stars, marketable players. I mean, Reese is coming back too, right? They're both juniors, her and Clark.
Well, I would think so. I mean, like,
well, they have to.
She's probably going to make more money in college. Did you hear the reports of how much she's making?
Yeah. So the point is, you have now big-time stars that people are going to be really excited to watch.
Yeah.
And you need to outfit your game a little bit to complement that and make sure that you're not having stars falling out halfway through the fourth quarter.
Well, I sent you a text
on warning all the way through the game.
Like, yeah, I sent you a text that said, like, I think there were 28 fouls in the first 30 minutes.
Yeah,
like,
so
that's not.
I think they just need to
do that.
Need to invest in some better referees and kind of sending down the mandates about how it needs to be handled to help get yourself a TV deal, because that's the biggest thing. Right.
Well, they have TV deals, don't they?
Well, right, but in future negotiations, you're sitting down with the provider. Provider says, I don't want the person everyone's tuning in to see fouling out in the third quarter.
Like, well, it's the
it
whole...
It needs to be fixed.
The reason that, like, Kobe and LeBron don't foul out,
right,
like, in games
when you
ever
become a league with lots of money involved and lots of TV money, suddenly you change some things to make sure that you get the people what they want.
So we just have to make college hockey really popular?
Yeah, that's a lot of the issues of the college hockey stems from the fact it doesn't bring in any money. We talked about this last week, that the various problems and ways things are designed to benefit small teams is because the big teams don't really bring in that much money.
Is that part of why we're doing a podcast, is so that people listen and then care about and attempt to watch these games? Attempt on BTN minus?
One thing I did want to bring up before we get going as a final point on a conversation last week. I found this.
Okay.
These are the programs that spent the most money.
Oh, yeah. I saw this.
On,
you sent it to me, I think.
Yeah, college hockey this season.
So now this is like all-inclusive, right? Like,
yep.
It's like hockey tape. It would be included. Like anything.
I would assume so. It's
anything,
just expenses.
Anything that the program spent regarding hockey. Okay.
North Dakota, Minnesota, Notre Dame, Michigan.
North Dakota's number one?
Yep.
Okay.
North Dakota, Minnesota, Notre Dame, Michigan, Boston College, Wisconsin, Penn State, Denver, MSU, Providence, Ohio State.
Are there any in there? So how many is that?
That's the top 11.
Okay.
And all seven Big Ten teams are in the top 11.
Are there any in there that are surprising to you?
Not really, no. And I will say that my guess is that the gap between Michigan and some of the other programs is probably mostly accountable for head coaching salary. Because this is the current season, and I would doubt that Brandon Nerada was getting paid much of anything.
Because he was an intern.
He was an interim.
Yeah.
I mean, I assume he was still coaching on his assistant coach salary, right? And they're not paying a buyout to Mel, so their coaching cost is probably way lower than...
So how much did they spend?
Michigan spent $4.46 million.
And what did North Dakota spend?
They spent $5.45 million, so Michigan wouldn't
bridge
that gap, but they would probably catch up to Notre Dame and Minnesota. if you have an actual head coach salary.
But that's
there.
Not. But it's a we're talking about less than $1 million in
sure.
college sport.
Sure.
Yeah.
But point is, Big Ten spends a lot of money, and that's why there is a lot of upside.
Well, they have a lot of money.
And we will talk about them spending that money on new coaches
in the next segment. Do you, all right, so then the only other thing that I had written down that if you want to get out is, did you have any spring game quick hitters?
No.
Just nothing.
I mean, I put up any the instant takes I had on the site.
So there's no, like,
go read that.
Later reaction after that?
I haven't rewatched it, so no.
Well, I mean, like, from the Michigan Twitter sphere, which you, like, invented, right? You're, like, the one of the starters of Michigan Twitter?
No, but, no, I don't really have any other takes.
Okay. They didn't play a lot of players that probably are going to start, so.
Well, that's what the spring game is about. It's about
right.
seeing the battle for the seventh string running back and stuff like that.
It's like taking all of baseball spring training games and putting them into, like, 2 hours.
Yeah.
Just, like, extrapolating from three plays.
Pretty basically. Much.
Yeah. All right. Well, the way that we're going to structure this podcast is we thought we'd talk about the three teams and preview all three teams, probably Quinnipiac a little bit heavier because it's guaranteed that Michigan's going to play them since that
also
one of the teams doesn't
forfeit. Also, we haven't
forfeit.
Seen them before.
Well, we saw them last year.
Well, no, but not this year. The other two teams in the Frozen Four we
do
have
they,
seen.
Do they change from year to year? Aren't they just Quinnipiac?
No, there's some new stuff to talk about.
It's a joke. And then we'll go through BU and Minnesota, and hopefully Michigan will see one of those teams by the end of the weekend and beat both of them. Anyway, okay, so first we have Quinnipiac. I thought I'd go through the numbers that I usually talk about, and then you can build off of that. I know you did a rewatch, I believe, on at least one of the games, or at least
Ohio
parts
State
of it.
Game, yeah.
Yeah, which is probably the one game in their season that you would, you know, maybe one of the Harvard games, but Ohio State's probably...
Ohio State's the best team they played. I don't know how useful it is. We'll get into that in a minute.
Because of the style and everything. So Quinnipiac finishes the year, including in the tournament, they're up to number 2 in Corsi. Not a surprise because of a lot of their competition. 23% of the power play is pretty good, and 86% of the penalty kill is really good. I mean, what we talked about Ohio State all year having what? They were up at like 89 to 90.
Yep.
And so that's not too far down. They don't have a ton of drafted players. They have two... and they have about, this is the interesting thing that I found, and you know, we can get into this a little bit. I'm sure you'll have something to say, but they do have six players that are scoring over 0.75 points per game. So it's not just one particular guy or two particular guys, because they do have one kind of, I don't know, college hockey superstar that is scoring at a pretty high rate. Colin Graf, I believe, is about a little over 1.5 points per game. And then we get to the goalie, 1.46 GAA and a save percentage of 9.32 for Peretz. He's good. We saw him last year. And they are relatively hot, 4-1 coming in. Obviously, they're going to win a couple of games at least to get to this point. And the one game they lost, I believe, was the Colgate game in overtime. So that was also a tight game. So, I mean, my quick takeaway from this team is that, you know, we've talked about Quinnipiac and the conference that they play in and the schedule that they play and stuff sort of off and on throughout the year. And in, you know, single game elimination, anything can happen. I think all four teams are good. But at the end of the day, if you're any of these teams and you get to control who you pick, getting Quinnipiac instead of Michigan, Minnesota, or BU is probably, you know, the biggest win to start, at least on paper.
Yeah. Quinnipiac, they have been a really good program for a while.
Well, they've only had one coach, right? I mean, Pecknold brought them up.
He brought them up to D1, yes.
And that was, what, 20-ish years ago?
It was right around 2000.
Yeah.
He's been there since, like, the early to mid-90s.
Yeah.
He was very young when he started there.
So he was just like...
Because he's not that old.
He's just a kid, and like, all right. Here we go.
And he's 56. Then, he's not like Jeff Jackson where he's on his last legs.
85.
Yeah. Yeah, he started there in 1994, so he was 27 when he took over Quinnipiac.
That's like... That's almost,
10 years younger than Brandon Nerado.
That's like almost your age.
Yeah, getting there. So, Rand Pecknold really is Quinnipiac hockey.
Yeah.
He brought them up to the D1 level, and they are... a team that's been really competitive since then. They have made two Frozen Fours previously. They made the 2013 Frozen Four.
Played in the title game that year, I think.
And they lost to a bad Yale team.
Oh, that's
probably
right.
One of the most humiliating experiences to be the number one overall seed and lose to 4-seed Yale in the national
title. Oh, that's right. They were a four that year.
Yeah, Yale beat UMass Lowell and Connor Hellebuck. And then they beat number one overall seed Quinnipiac.
That was wild. That's like, that was like the nail in the coffin for the NCAA tournament being like.
And that was on a jump the shark.
A real thing, right? Like, it's just like, okay, now we have a four seed, and not even like a good four seed, a bad four seed that wins a national title.
What's interesting about that year is that Quinnipiac did not face a one or a two seed in the tournament. They beat 4-seed Canisius, 3-seed Union, 4-seed St. Cloud, and lost to 4-seed Yale. They played three of the four or fours that year. Pretty weird year. Don't know how they didn't win the title.
I watched some of that title game, too.
And then they were back a few years later. The last time the Frozen Four was in Tampa, they were in the title game in 2016, and they lost.
Devontae's on that team?
He might have been.
I think he was.
They lost to North Dakota and Brock Besser that year.
Oh, yeah, because North Dakota beat Michigan in Cincinnati.
Yep. Taves was on that team. Mm-hmm. That was his last year with Quinnipiac. So since then, they have come up short in the tournament a couple times. 2019, they lost in the regional final. 2021, they lost in the first round. Last year, they lose to Michigan in the regional final. So that's a really good program.
Yeah.
They're very sustainable. This year's team specifically, they have a couple big-time stars. I think their best player is Zach Metza, a defenseman, 33 points in 38 games.
That's pretty good.
I was really impressed with him. I thought the way he was really controlling the game in the neutral zone.
And he's a grad student, too.
Yep, so they have 10 of their 19 skaters in the Ohio State game are seniors or fifth-year players. Only four are freshmen, so
yeah,
an older and more veteran team, but you know, very very college hockey team in a lot of ways in terms of their build. But Metza is really good. I like him a lot. Their defense in particular is pretty veteran. They have a smaller defense, which is interesting. I didn't see them have too many issues against Ohio State with the size, but I would be curious to see the Fantilli and Rucker McGroarty line going up against some of those guys. Metza, 5'9", 180. Jacob Norquist, 5'9", 181.
Oof.
Jaden Lee, 5'9", 160.
Wow.
So, those are smaller guys. Metza reminds me a lot of Nick Blankenberg in a lot of ways. There's some similarities there size-wise in the way they play. Metza's the point man on the power play, too. Just a really important player for them. And then their forward group, they have the top line of Colin Graff.
Who's young? He's a sophomore.
This is a sophomore freshman line. Colin Graff and Lipkin and Jacob Quillen.
Yeah.
They have 56, 39, and 34 points. They do a lot of the scoring for the team. Graff's a good player. I didn't get a ton of notes on him in that one game I did see, but he's up for the Hobie, unsurprisingly. So that's the line that does a lot of their.
Well, he didn't make the hat trick.
Right. He was in the top 10.
Okay. I see what you mean. Yeah.
And then the second line, which I think is worth talking about, and this I think is going to be their matchup line. Quinnipiac will be the home team, so Rampagnon will get to see what Brendan Nerado does for faceoffs. And my assumption is that when Nerado puts out the Fantilli line, you will see Pecknold put out the line of Skylar Brindamore centering Bergart and Ethan, is it DeYoung or DeJong? I would assume DeYoung. That's normally how that name is pronounced, with a J.
Is he related to Nolan?
They're both from BC, but they're from different parts of BC.
So
I don't
probably
think they're related.
Not. Maybe cousins.
But anyway, that line is, I think, going to be their matchup line because Skylar Brindamore is their top face-off artist. We don't have face-off stats, do we, in College Hockey News?
Not per player.
Not per player, yeah. They showed a stat during that game that he was firing at like 65 or 70% for the regional. So that's a major asset.
But they also score, that line does. I mean, they
do some
two
scoring.
Guys. I mean, DeYoung has 39 points in 39 games.
DeYoung does a lot of his scoring on the power play.
Okay.
And Brindamore does as well. Those two guys. Brindamore, we'll get to the power play in a moment. But anyway, point is with that line, DeJong and Brendan Moore are also their top penalty kill tandem for forwards.
Wow.
So that's kind of their defense matchup line, and that they'll do a lot of work on the penalty kill as well. Skyler Brendan Moore is a lot... he's basically the NCAA version of Rod Brendan Moore in terms of a lot of the same things that Rod Brendan Moore did at the NHL level is what Skyler does in winning faceoffs and intangibles and heart and all that stuff.
So the opposite of Juwan and Jed Howard.
Not sure about steroid rumors, but if that was an inherited trait. But anyway, and then an interesting thing is, I believe this was their third line. It might have been their fourth line. They didn't post a line chart, so I made the lines myself watching the game.
Just based on what you watch?
Yeah, just to see who's on the ice to kind of scribble them down.
Sure.
TJ Friedman is still listed on College Hockey News as a defenseman. He's a center. He was not playing defense in this game. And his point totals reflect that. He's a forward. I don't know why he's still listed as
a defenseman.
Yeah,
he had 11 goals.
Yeah, he's not a defenseman. I was a little confused by that when I was watching the game. But he's on a line with Michael Lombardi and Cipollone, Joey Cipollone. That's an older line, at least with Cipollone on it and Friedman being a grad student. And then their fourth line, Tellier with Filion. And this is one I didn't bother trying to pronounce. I just wrote down VC in my line chart.
Victor
Chernekianar.
Yeah, that's pretty close.
I couldn't find it.
Cernekianar. That's how what I would say.
Cernekianar. That's a good pronunciation. Yeah, so that's their other line. So those are their four lines. The Graf line does a lot of the scoring. The Brendan Moore line will do the matchup, and then you got your third and fourth line.
So they have two Cipollones. Joey and Anthony.
Yes, I guess Anthony
doesn't play a whole lot. Yeah. He only plays 14.
Yeah, he's a freshman. So, but that's their layout. They're a really good possession based team, partially because the teams they play against. Their power play, they do a standard 1-3-1. Metsä, it's a point. Brendan Moore at the net front to the goal line.
Makes sense.
DeJong is the bumper, and they love to tee him up. They love to go, you know, wing to Brendan Moore, then into the slot, that play.
Like the point low.
And then Lipkin and Graf are the wings on that power play unit. So that's their first unit.
Are they good shooters? I mean, their shooting percentages are pretty high.
They didn't do a whole lot on the power play against Ohio State for obvious reasons. Well. And power play two is a two defenseman unit, Norquist and Lee on that unit at the points. And then Tellier, Filion, and Quillen were the three forwards. Tellier was the one, I believe, who scored the insurance goal on the power play to put that game away. Yes, he was the one who scored that. Penalty kill, pretty standard 1-2-1 diamond, kind of alignment in the zone. They're a good penalty kill team. In terms of their neutral or even strength game, the biggest thing to talk about with them is they're just really well-structured defensively. And the Ohio State game, I thought, was a tough one for me to watch and get a feel of because, and this is the problem with the NCAA tournament, so you can watch that game and you come away from it. If you ask me who would win a 7-game series between Ohio State and Quinnipiac, I honestly wouldn't really know because I don't think that game told us that much. Here's the problem with the game. There were about 2 total minutes out of 60 that the game was tied. Ohio State scored 90 seconds in.
Yeah.
They held a lead for about 10 to 12 minutes. Quinnipiac ties it and then scores the go-ahead in about 30 seconds. So you had 2 total minutes where you got to see the teams on even footing without score effect.
Yeah.
Now, Ohio State up 1-0 very early in the game isn't much of a score effect, but Quinnipiac going up 2-1 towards the end of the first period is a massive score effect.
Yeah.
So we didn't really get to see these two teams going at it without different score effect components going on.
But the thing...
I thought when we saw Ohio State up 1-0 that period of the first period, I thought it was pretty even. I thought Quinnipiac was a little better, but it was early, and it was one game feeling each other out. So we didn't really get to learn that much. But what you really did get to see is how Quinnipiac defends when they take a lead. You know, they never had a lead against Michigan last year.
No, so Michigan scored early.
They scored early. Michigan was up by a lot at the end of two periods.
Yeah.
Then you had the hard charge in the third. So we didn't really get to see against Michigan how they defend, but... what you see when you watch this team, they don't give up a lot of odd man rushes. Gave up, I believe, like 1 total in that game, and it was the Dunlap goal for Ohio State, a breakaway and a really bad pass. And then after that, they just are really well drilled. They know where to be. They know how to set up in the defensive zone, in zone defensively. You're very rarely going to see them have any players in the zone outside of puck battles go wider than the face-off dots.
Hmm.
So if you drew a line vertically from the face-off dots, from the blue line to the end board on both sides, that center column is where they're going to be.
Yeah.
And
well, because that's why they don't give up odd man rushes.
Oh, right. But they don't, in zone, they don't play a lot of man. They are mostly just staying inside that column and switching.
Mm-hmm.
And they'll let you go all around them. If you want to just skate around the perimeter endlessly, they're pretty content to let you do that.
Well, Michigan,
they're
not gonna, Michigan will do that from time
to time. They're not
going to
come out and really challenge you on the puck that much, because if you're playing man with that pressure, that's how you then get broken down if it doesn't work.
Right.
Right? So you're just not going to see a lot of times where you have numbers advantages down low in the zone off of cycle plays, because they just don't come out far enough to really do that. If there's a loose puck, then they'll commit, but they'll be very quick to coming right back to protecting that center column. So they block a lot of shots, and as a result, they don't put their goalie in hard positions.
So does that sort of benefit Michigan because they have defensemen that can move and skate and change angles on guys and therefore get passes off when they're between, like, in transition between defensemen? Not defensemen, but defenders. Like, because I remember Hughes made a really nice play last year. I think it was on the first goal to either Lambert or Van Wy who scored it, but he comes down from the point and beats his guy, gets in front, and then forces someone to step up. And so I know you're not playing a lot of man, but, you know, when you shake a guy up top, there has to be...
I think what I want to see the most is, like, backdoor cutting action from Michigan.
Like, from the back of side defenseman, or the backside
wing? Or from a wing, or whatever.
Yeah.
Because
okay.
I think that with this team, and they're not playing man that much, and they're really just strict to their spot, if you have a puck carrier with mobility around the perimeter, and then they're all kind of watching and just... you know, holding their spots. If you get a kind of slash in real quick and you can fit a pass through a tight window, that might be one of your best plays. It's not going to be easy. It's not going to be easy to score against this team. I think you're going to want to do damage off rebounds. I think putting some shots on net and creating that chaos is going to be one of your better ways to go about things.
Well, we haven't talked about Parrott much yet, but he's not large. He's, I think, 6'1", which used to be very large. But... so you might be right. Is he's not going to have the size in the net that, you know, Guylander had or that Portillo has?
Yeah, I mean, I think that my feeling on Yaniv Peretz is that he's a good goalie. He's not an elite goalie. His save percentage is very high nationally, but you have to examine the kind of role that he plays.
And who's taking those shots?
Well, it's .932 save percentage, but when you compare him to the other goalies in the country... Pietilo is now down to .924 after
wow.
the Penn State debacle.
Yeah,
he was up there. But Levi at .933 and Bischel .931. You kind of compare those two, and what you see is that Peretz is not facing a lot of quality looks. He's rarely facing rush chances. He's not facing a lot of high danger chances. And generally, when you play behind a possession-dominant team that isn't exposing you to much, in college hockey, you want to be in the .940 to .950 range. And that he's down at .932 shows that he's a good goalie, but he's not elite.
Yep.
Now, they can't just make anybody into a .930 goalie. That's not how it works. We saw that with Minnesota State. If you have a guy that's actually bad, even if you're a possession-dominant team that limits chances, he's not going to be higher than .910 or .915. Right? If
yep.
he's bad, he's bad. Peretz is good. No question about that. But if he were elite, he'd probably have a higher save percentage. And I think that's pretty clear. You know, he doesn't give up a lot of goals because they just don't face a lot of good teams. But Michigan was able to get some by him last year, and they forced the goalie change to bring St. Cyr in. I mean, North Dakota scored 5 on him in one of their non-conference games, so it's definitely doable. You might want a little bit of a gift from him. But overall, my thought about this team, again, was all about the defensive aspect, because I didn't see them create a lot of offense against Ohio State, especially at 5-on-5. And the goals they score in that game were not a lot of doing of their own.
I mean, Dobisch at least gave one or two away.
So he gives
away,
one
right?
away on the first one they scored.
Yeah.
2-on-2 entry, weak wrist shot. He coughs it up right on the doorstep for a rebound goal. I mean, that's just, he didn't do anything. He just took advantage of a mistake.
Yep.
And then right after that, you get a point shot that takes a huge bounce off the M board, kicks out the far side. There's a guy right there to put it on net. Dobish makes the save, but then he's down. It's a mad scramble, and then boom, it goes in. Again, it's just two lucky goals. I mean, it wasn't goals that I sit there and say anything about. You got to add this to the scouting report.
Like the NHL skill or something like that.
I mean, it's just nothing in particular. It's like they put pucks on net, and they got rewarded in weird ways, but that's the NCAA tournament. So then the third goal they score is at the tail of the end of a power play, which was another weird one. It was that one where Tellier flips it up into the air over Dobish and then bats it out of midair.
Oh, that's right, yeah.
And then Dobish leans across with the glove.
Makes a great save.
But it was across the line.
And
it was watching these, it's like, okay, there's nothing to learn here. These are just goofy goals. So I wasn't able to get a great look at their offensive side of it. I might watch one of their games against Harvard maybe before I write the preview to get a little better sense of that. But defensively, again, they're rock solid in zone. I thought Peretz against Ohio State, he let in the goal on one of the only high danger chances he faced, which was not a great sign. But in zone, he's really sharp. He's not facing quality looks, but part of that is when you have a defensive structure where everyone is going to be taking away the center of the ice, that means a lot of times shots are going to be coming through bodies. So your biggest thing as a goalie is finding the puck, making sure you're seeing it, making sure you're in position. And he was very sharp at that. He wasn't giving up rebounds. He was squeezing it. That's what you want behind a good defense.
But you did say that their defensemen do struggle with size because they can't. They are small, and Fantilli is a bigger physical player. Rucker McGroarty, also a bigger guy who has a tendency to get in and around the net. You know, even Luke Hughes on his carry-ins, he's a taller guy too. So, I mean, Michigan...
Yeah, I would look to see Fantilli try and take the puck and instead of skating around the perimeter, just try to...
Just get to the net.
...bully his way in and see if you can get a mad scramble and a look there. I think that's one of your better options. And then when they were in the third period trying to shut the game down, they were going to a 1-3-1 neutral zone forecheck, which you don't see a lot of. That was a scheme that came to life under Guy Boucher and the Tampa Bay Lightning in 2011, and then hasn't... A lot of teams don't run that. Again, because I didn't see a lot of this game when it was tied, I didn't get a feel for what they do in a tied situation. But third period, I mean, 17 and a half minutes to go protecting a one-goal lead. That's a lot of time, and there they are in a 1-3-1 with, you know, F1 just basically providing performative pressure, and then just three-man stack right at the blue line and another guy even behind that. And it's like, here we go.
But that's what they do, though, is like you said.
Right. I mean, it's just that a 1-3-1 is the trappiest of all traps, even more so than, you know, the good old Lemaire 1-2-2. So you see that with 17 and a half minutes to go in a game, and you're like, here we are.
But that's also probably what you do to Ohio State, too, because Ohio State gets a lot of their chances, at least against Michigan, off the rush or off their forecheck. And so if you don't give them chances to do that and you force them to come in and create stuff, you know, Ohio State did not have the guys this year anyway that were really going to create a lot of dangerous chances in zone. I mean, they didn't even do that against Michigan.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the 1-3-1, you know, the big upside is you take away the center of the ice just like they do in the defensive zone. And you have that line standing you up at the blue line, so you force a lot of dump-ins. That's how they're going to do it.
Yeah.
And that's what they're going to want to do to slow Michigan down. As soon as they get a lead, they're going to start protecting. Ohio State took a ton of shots and a ton of shot attempts after Quinnipiac went up 2-1.
Were they from good places?
Not really. And that's why Quinnipiac was content with it. So it's going to be hard to come from behind against this team, but it's hard to come from behind against any team in the NCAA tournament or in a Game 7 in the NHL. Teams just play that differently, and in a lot of times the first goal wins in those games. So that's a big point of discussion looking at this team. The one thing I'll say about their breakouts, I thought were really well-drilled in their breakouts. They don't have a lot of Ethan Edwards skating the puck out. They do a lot of quick passing. And they know exactly where to go with the puck. Just boom, boom, boom. You know, three quick passes and it's out. And they're content to chip or rim as well. They are really good at that. They're not going to give you a ton of opportunities to bear down on them on the forecheck. Which is why I thought going into that game they were a good matchup for Ohio State, in the sense that Ohio State, they weren't going to give Ohio State what Ohio State wants. Ohio State wants to pounce on Seamus Casey trying to do too much with it.
Yep.
And they're like, we're not going to do that. you know, our defensemen, they're just going to, as soon as they get the puck, make one quick pass, and it's out of their hands. So you're not going to come after us with that. So this is, it's just a well-coached team. I'm impressed with these guys. Pecknold runs a good program. They win a lot of games, despite the talent level that they have, because they're well-coached. And it's going to be not the easiest battle, but... Again, it's going to probably come down to the whole feel of the game will change when one goal goes in, whoever scores that goal.
Yeah, I think it's probably bigger for Quinnipiac to get that goal because of the way that Michigan plays, where, you know, you can catch Michigan in odd man rushes. And, you know, power plays, if they take a penalty, you can get back into it off of that. But if Quinnipiac is allowed to go into their game killer mode like that, you know, not saying that Michigan can't overcome that, because I think that they can. We've seen them get goals against those teams in the past, but that just kind of fits exactly into their game plan.
Yeah, the other thing to note, as we've talked about, they ain't played nobody. They never do.
Well, I mentioned this, I think, on the podcast last week, where I think if you just look at tournament teams, I think they were 6-3, if I remember correctly, and like three of those games were against Colgate. So they've only really
played... and they don't play Colgate very well.
They've struggled with Colgate.
This is the interesting stat about that. I was looking at this.
They're like 1-2 against Colgate.
They scored in about 10.5 periods against Colgate. 1 5-on-5 goal.
Well, Michigan did a little bit better than that last time I checked.
But on the flip side, Harvard, who I think was undisputably a better team than Colgate, they just manhandled them.
Yeah, they did twice.
Blasted them right off the map. Now, we saw Harvard get exposed. They're probably not great, but they're better than Colgate. And Quinnipiac, you know, spanked them. So I don't know what to say about that. They're non-conference. It's...
Well, they took a shot, and they got the wrong year for North Dakota, which was not a bad hire. Not a bad, like, schedule.
They played BC.
Which is not a bad pick either.
Well, I think they knew coming into the...
But
these aren't being scheduled in 2015.
That's true.
It's not college football.
BC's not Maine.
No. Well, they did play Maine.
Well, there you go.
They got BC, NoDak twice, Maine twice, Dartmouth.
What?
It was a non-con Dartmouth game.
But aren't they in the same conference?
They are, yeah.
And they scheduled for non-con?
Well, do you know why that was non-con?
Was it in a tournament or something?
It was in the Friendship Four. Do you want to guess where that was played?
In Montreal.
Belfast, Northern Ireland.
Wasn't that... Oh, you remember when those... We talked about those games. We talked that there were two games over in
Northern Ireland.
Because they were like, why are they at 2 o'clock? This isn't a Long Island game.
They also played UMass over in Northern Ireland.
Right.
Then they got Holy Cross.
Well, in each of the past like 4 years, UMass would have been a good schedule. This year, not so much.
Long Island twice.
Wow.
And then in the Connecticut Ice Tournament... They got Sacred Heart and UConn.
Well, UConn wasn't a bad
team. They were okay. So, not a lot going on there.
No.
It's Ohio State and Merrimack, who they faced in the tournament, were
two of their best teams
they played, I think, probably. Maybe we could have seen Harvard play
Harvard,
Merrimack.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know. But the point is, it's hard to get a feel for this team. They don't play a lot of teams.
Well, we watched them last year. We know what they do.
I think that there's no question in my mind that they can beat Michigan. There's no question in my mind they can beat Michigan if Michigan's goalie gives away a goal and then has a weird one bounce off the end boards.
Yep.
So that's...
But that's
college
hockey.
Welcome
to all of college hockey.
Yep.
But I don't... I mean, if you were betting on the percentages of this game, I mean, Michigan's probably going to be favored. I didn't look at what the Cratch ratings were.
Quinnipiac has a slight edge in the Cratch, but...
Really?
Yeah.
Because...
I don't know. I don't know how Cratch is calculated.
you always know those things. So Quinnipiac is actually favored in this game? Well, I don't know what Vegas
is. What the Vegas odds are, I guess. I don't know.
Oh, you're not Ryan Zook. You don't need to go look
again, strength of schedule, 42nd for QPAC, 2nd for Michigan. That's a big story.
I mean, I mean, we have... You know, picks that we're going to make and a preview that we'll post in, I don't know, what day is this coming out? Tuesday. So that'll post Wednesday. But, I mean, Michigan could lose this game. It's just that, like I said, all the matchups, this is going to have, Quinnipiac is going to have the least amount of overall talent. They might be really good defensively. They might get good goaling. They might get good bounces, and they might win the game. That's, you know, we're at the point for 2 years in a row in college hockey where you have all the teams that are there could win the national championship, and no one should be shocked. Yep. You can be a little bit more surprised in a win, in one game or another, but there's no bad teams anymore. We're down to chalk.
Pretty much.
Anything else, or should we move on to BU?
We can move on.
All right. So, BU we saw, what, twice this year? Like, a year ago, it feels like. Back in, I think, the second series of the year after Lindenwood, Michigan drew the Terriers at Yost. And the first game was unlike any game I had ever seen, in that Michigan is up 4-0 at the end of the first period, but they get, I think, 5-on-3 goals because somehow BU takes 2 5-minute majors that overlap, which then breaks the stat scoring system so that shots and attempts and pretty much everything on the scoreboard and in the printouts was toast. And eventually, I think things were recalibrated, but it was never really a game after the first period. And then in the second game, you know, BU probably outplays Michigan 5-on-5. Michigan does have a 1-0 lead. They have a 2-1 lead. And then BU scores a couple of times in the mid to late second period, takes the lead. Michigan threatens to tie, but can't do it. And you end up with a split, which was probably fair to some extent. But BU's also loaded with talent, as we'll get into their numbers. They were about 12th in Corsi, which is good. Their power play percentage is 20, which is fine to good. Penalty kills at 81. That's good, too. They have 12 drafted skaters. I knocked it down to 11 because I don't think Case McCarthy is going to play. I mean, maybe he is, but that injury looked pretty bad a week ago. So I'm not counting on that. Seven skaters that are scoring over 0.75 points per game. So they do have a bunch of players that contribute on offense. Their goaltending, you know, it's okay. Drew Comesso has been fine, but he's a 2.41 GAA and a 9.14 save percentage is fine. And they have been hot. And the thing about them to know is that I have deemed them as the wizard sorcerers in hat inheritors from Minnesota Duluth, as they have had. I mean, we followed them through the course of the year, and they had a number of late third period tying goals, winning goals, overtimes. Their Hockey East tournament was defined by a couple of big overtime wins. They didn't need to do that in the NCAA regional because they kind of walked away from Western Michigan, and then they just sort of outlasted Cornell. Cornell never really threatened too deeply until late in that game to get to Tampa. But BU's a pretty good overall team. They were pretty much a one, maybe dipped down to a two, but they were in it as for a one seed pretty much the entire year.
Yeah, BU's good team, no question. They don't have that many NHL players, but they have a lot of picks, which is often in college hockey a great way to win.
Because you get guys that are drafted.
They get to stay.
But they're not yanked away right away.
Yeah, you get them up in upperclassmen. So building a team through juniors and seniors that were fifth-round picks is a really good way to win in college
hockey. I mean, Denver did that, right? I mean,
yeah, they are the team in this Frozen Four that most resembles Denver from last year, and that's good news for them. So definitely they have the advantage of that, and then they have one mega freshman in Lane Hutson, who's had an incredible, incredible season, 48 points in 38 games.
Which is better than Hughes if from a production standpoint.
Yeah, I think he's had a better year than Hughes, no doubt.
But he's small.
He's very small, and that was
5'9", 155.
He's really like 5'7".
5'7", 145.
That was the big question when he came through the draft last year.
Well, they have another defenseman who's also 5'7".
A few guys in last year's draft were more controversial as a prospect than Lane Hutson. And the thought was, wow, this guy is really impressive. He's really skilled. He's really good. But could it work in the NHL? Well, we still don't know. But we do know it works in college hockey. And that's good news for him. And it's good news for their team. He's a guy that really controls their entire offense in a way that you don't see too often with defensemen. You see great defensemen who are pillars at both ends of the ice that really control the feel of the game at both ends of the rink, things like that. Your Victor Hedmans and Nick Lidstroms and such. But Hudson's a lot more like when Erik Karlsson was on the Senators, and it's just like, this is the guy with the keys to our offense, and we, the forwards, will let him do whatever, and he drives it. I mean, Hudson's just such an impressive player. Really good season from him. And then, again, they have older veteran players like Luke Tuck, who's a junior, and Dominic Fensori, who's a senior, and Jay O'Brien, who's a senior. And
Fensori's the other really small guy.
Yeah, he's a small guy. One of the best names in college hockey, Wilmer Skoog. 31 points and 16 goals. He's a senior as well. So they have a good mix of those talented guys and older guys. And yeah, the goaltending is one of the questions for me. But I think looking at this matchup with Minnesota, I don't love Kemeso. I also don't love Justin Close. So.
Well, we've seen Close a number of times and we've gotten similar results.
The interesting thing is Vinny Duplessis played most of the series against Michigan. Kemeso got chased on Friday,
and then
Duplessis played the rest of the way.
Oh, we were wondering if he got... And I don't think Kemeso... Is it true that Kemeso didn't dress on Sunday? I think we were debating if he got, like, shipped back to Boston after that Friday game.
One thing about if they play Michigan, they scored 2 5-on-5 goals that whole series.
Against Michigan?
Yeah, they've scored 5 in total, 3 on the power play.
Okay.
So that's just something to keep in mind. They're a really good team, no question about that. And I think at the moment, I'm kind of leaning towards them in that matchup with Minnesota, but it's got to that matchup's got to feel like the Michigan-Denver one last year. And then you got a team that's got this roster of mostly later round picks that is a little more veteran, that's hot, that has a little bit of a Team of Destiny feel to them, and are going to come in playing really loose and really excited to be there. And then you've got the other team, which is number one overall seed with a lot of NHL players, a team that has a lot of guys who came back to win a championship, who have been number one, close to wire, who the whole sense is this is our year.
Yeah.
And
I mean, they're Michigan last year.
Yep. And what that really shows and what it really, the risk is like, you know, this team... Do they come out tight? Do they come out scared? Like
well, you
Michigan
thought they did.
Did
a little bit
I thought
against
they did
Canisius.
Against Canisius, yeah. And I just wonder if they're going to be in their own heads a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, there's something to that. I mean, I don't know, are we transitioning to Minnesota yet, or are we...
Yeah, I mean...
So, you know, we can go over all the stuff about Minnesota. That's an interesting thing to say. I mean, at this point, you know, you have a lot of players on this team that have already been to this point, right? I mean, it's different coming out against Canisius because... You know, now, you know, Minnesota's coming off a loss, a disappointing loss to Michigan, where, you know, they were in their home building and they were probably the favorite to win the Big Ten tournament champions, and they didn't. And then it's their next game in a game that they need to win by 5 goals because they're that much better. You know, that's not this case anymore. You know, they played 2 tournament games. They looked better by the end of the third period against Canisius, and then they were never really threatened by St. Cloud. I mean, they were in control that whole game. So I don't necessarily think Minnesota is going to come out tight in that same sense because it's different. I don't necessarily think BU. I don't know that anyone will. I mean, maybe the only one that you would say is maybe Quinnipiac because they haven't been there in a long time, but I wouldn't expect that from them. They've played like that they belong at this level for a long time, and they played well in their regionals too. I think that all 4 of these teams, I think these are going to be 2 really good games. I mean, kind of like last year, except that, you know, you could say that the quality of players is probably higher this year across the board, especially in this game. I mean, you're going to have a lot of players that NHL teams have taken and that have invested in.
Yeah, this is really...
And they're similar teams. They're both going to want to skate. They're both going to want to shoot and score. You know, you might argue that BU has a little more depth in scoring, but, I mean, it's tough to top that. I mean, you know, the Fantilli line is the only line that probably compares to the Nyes, Cooley, Snuggerud line, and I would even give a little bit of the lean to the Nyes line over the Fantilli line across the board.
Yeah, this is the Minnesota BU game is a really marquee matchup for the sport. Thank God we're playing it at 5 o'clock on a Thursday. So,
so that's interesting. Let's just talk about this for a second. You know, from a Michigan perspective, I mean, we cover the team, but we're also fans. Do you want to just watch this game and not have to worry about if Michigan has already won or lost? Or would you rather take your shot that you're going to beat Quinnipiac and then kick up your heels and be like, all right, give me some popcorn and I'm ready to watch this crazy, awesome, wide-open, high-end college hockey game?
I always like being the second game.
You prefer to be the second
game? You get to watch the first one and be like, oh, this is fun.
Because you don't have an outcome yet.
Yeah, well, if you lose the... if you're the first game and you lose it, then you're like, I don't care about this.
How was that last year? We both did that.
Yeah. So, no, I much prefer to beat the second game. And I much prefer this outcome to the one in 2018 where we were the second game and we were watching the first game on pins and needles, begging Duluth to win that game.
Begging Duluth?
Yeah.
Well, I don't know. When I was watching Duluth, I was like, I don't know. That's not
good. He lost to Ohio State 5 times. You can't play them a 6th time and lose the national title. If that happens, you fold the program. We've been over
but
this.
But what are the odds?
You cannot lose.
What are the odds you go 0-6 against any team?
I don't know. You can't. You cannot get
you
in
can't
a.
Can't throw you, away my point.
You cannot
with an, I don't
get
know.
In a scenario
no.
where that is a possibility.
No. You can't live scared. We have different opinions. That's okay. We should get back on track and not talk about bad things that happened in St. Paul because that list is way too long. So Minnesota, we talked about the Nyes line. The other thing is, you know, they've had a couple of players step up to add some scoring depth there as well, where, you know, they have a senior in, what, Bryce Brodzinski. He's got 19 goals and 11 assists, so he's got 30 points. He's playing well. Mike Koster is and Brock Faber also support Jackson Lacombe, so they get a lot of scoring from their defense too. I mean, this isn't new. We've talked about this. I might say that Minnesota is a little bit more of a complete team. Would you say that?
Probably. I mean, they're a better team. They've got better players. But
yeah.
I don't have much to say on Minnesota other than what we've already said. I mean, we've seen this team a lot of times. They're a really good team, and they could easily win the title.
The one thing that I will say is that, you know, it kind of goes against the thing that we've been saying about Minnesota all year, but I don't think I hate the matchup with Minnesota. Because
no, I'd be very comfortable playing Minnesota.
We watched them the 3 times that Michigan has had a reasonably put together roster, and Michigan has skated with them. They've had leads in all 3 games. You know, they blew 2 of them, one of them in overtime, and then, you know, for the most part, outplayed Minnesota and got burned on a few odd man rushes and chances. But, you know, I think they controlled more of the offensive zone time and created stuff and probably could have had other goals. And I don't hate playing against Justin Close.
No.
So, not saying that I wouldn't feel comfortable against BU. I mean, that's part of the thing that I started to write a little bit in the preview is like, I don't know that Michigan isn't the hottest team or maybe even the best team in the country right now, the way they've been playing. And, you know, because they went into essentially won a road game at Penn State last weekend. They definitely won a road game at Minnesota the week before. They took down Ohio State, a team that had given them trouble throughout the year. I don't know what else you want, you know? I mean, they played really well in the back half of the Big Ten against the toughest conference. So, and then, I mean, that Minnesota game was huge, I think, even for nothing else, for confidence.
Any of these teams at this tournament could win it. I think that any of these teams you could make a compelling case for, and I'm not sure that anyone is really the favorite. Minnesota is the one that has the wire-to-wire and everything, but just watching the way the season has unfolded in recent weeks, I think all these teams have pretty good cases.
I think Seth said something like he would say that Minnesota has a 26% chance to win.
Sure.
And I was kind of like, that kind of makes a little bit of sense. But if you want to learn to like college hockey, watch these couple games.
I can't believe I'm doing this. If you find yourself in the penalty box, you want a Michigan man arguing your case, call criminal law attorney and former prosecutor Jonathan Paul tonight. It's 248 and 924 9458. Or visit his old website at MichiganLawGrad.com.
It's real simple. You got 2 more quarters and that's it. Now, most of you have been playing this game for 10 years. You got 2 more quarters, and after that, most of you will never play this game again as long as you live. I want you to take a moment, and I want you to look each other in the eyes. I want you to put each other in your hearts forever, because forever is about to happen here in just a few minutes.
I got my fans in the stands, my team on my back, my family in my heart. I put my city on the map. See, I'm cool with my school, but I know I can do better. I checked the mail yesterday and not one college letter, not one college offer after all this hard work. I'd be telling you a lie if I said it didn't hurt. So how do I stay focused in this game called life? And do I have a fair chance when this world's so shite? See, we all pay a price. I got some things on my mind, but I need to regain my focus, cause it's game time. Give all, leave nothing. In the end, I gotta choose. Clear eyes, full heart, I can't lose. Clear eyes.
All right, now that we've gone over basically all the teams that Michigan could and hopefully will face next weekend or this weekend in Tampa, there are a number of tidbits that we can talk about Big Ten and college hockey wide. Obviously, the first one being the fact that we get an email and an announcement from Christie and the Michigan Athletic Department that Brandon Nerado is no longer the interim head coach at Michigan. He is the permanent head coach of Michigan. I believe details are to come out after the more important games are played this weekend. I'm not, like, shocked at this. I mean, we've debated it back and forth. There's been plenty of comments in both of the things that we write and on social media and everywhere about, like, why are they going to take the tag off? And is it time to take the tag off? And should they? And should they get somebody else? And blah, blah, blah. I don't think that Michigan handled it wrong. I don't think that waiting a while was a bad idea. I don't think it hurt them in any way. Their recruiting seemed to be fine. Obviously, you know, people inside the program or around the staff are going to be wanting a secure job earlier, but I don't think that playing out a lot of the season and watching what happened is necessarily the wrong move either.
No, I was always of the belief to let the season play out, and that's what they did. Obviously, it's not entirely finished, but I think it got to a point that the remainder of the season was not going to change the ultimate decision. And then at that point, you know, it was time to start sitting down and talking. I came into this season with an open mind when I wanted a national coaching search in the off season.
But you mean last off season?
Correct.
Yeah. Well, but we didn't even start the process until, like,
that was the problem.
Football season.
It was very badly handled,
yeah,
and thus it put them in a tougher position. I still think they could have pulled one off because Michigan is such an enticing job that you would have gotten plenty of candidates to listen. Look, at the end of the day, I have said many times that I think that Michigan hockey is the best program in the country. And so
has the highest ceiling.
And thus my belief is that Michigan should have the best coach in the country. And therefore, I have a very high standard, and I wasn't going to get excited when Brandon Nerado signed a 5-star.
Like, yeah.
Great.
You should.
You should.
Yeah.
I expect very, very high things. And so I wanted to see the season play out and see if he provided a window into being able to achieve those things. And, you know, they had a very choppy beginning because of how late they came into office. And then, you know, the illness and all that stuff in the fall. And so it took a bit of time. And that's why I was always in favor of letting it play out, is seeing. And when we got to the Christmas and, you know, New Year's break, that was when I said, you know, in the second half, things I want to see.
Mm-hmm.
And the team make the tournament.
Which they did.
And the team,
pretty convincingly,
team play better in the second half, play more consistent and improve.
Also did that, especially down the stretch.
And so it took time for, you know, it was by the late January, it was clear they were going to make the tournament. But yeah, the part about playing better and improving, it took a while for me to get on board with that. I wanted to see them put together really complete games, and it really wasn't until the Big Ten tournament that they started doing that, and then they did a few of them in a row, and that was the point at which I was like, okay. I went into the NCAA tournament basically saying I want to see them play, you know, again, continue to play these sort of consistent games. And I was not hinging my opinion on whether they won the Penn State game. I just wanted to see them come out and play a good game. And when they did that, I was like, okay, win or lose this game in the third period, I was like, I think I'm at that point.
Yeah.
I've seen enough. I'm not somebody, I have no ties to Mel. I've never met Mel. I've never met Brandon. I don't know any of these people. I just sit at home and watch the games.
Yep.
So that put me in a different position than a number of the writers and other analysts who, from their writing, you know, you can tell have a more close relationship with some of these people. I just watched the games and evaluate the results and what I see, and it took them a while, but it was a young team and it was a new coaching staff, and eventually they figured it out. And at that point, I was like, okay,
well,
you can get a shot to make this happen. I think I've seen enough to believe it's sustainable and they can roll it forward. Part of it, too, is the fact that he's a first-year head coach. And that's generally something that, for me, as a person thinking about the program, I ideally don't want Michigan to ever have a first-year head coach.
Yeah.
I want them to be able to just pluck whoever they want who's really good and come in and do that. But they got put in this position. And look, in the offseason, when I very briefly made my list of candidates, Narada was pretty high. He was in the top 3 to 5 of my list.
Well, we talked about it on the Summer Hockey Cast when that happened.
Yep.
About, like, we were kind of excited and thought that
I had heard good things and I was willing to see what he had, and
given the circumstances, it seemed like at that time they went in the right direction for this particular year.
Yep. And it took a bit of time to get the systems installed and get the players on board and everything, but they did enough down the stretch that I think it makes sense to give him a shot to keep it going.
Well, and the other thing is, like, you look at this team and you say, what could be better about it? And there's kind of one thing that I think you and I would both like to see be a little bit better. But, I mean, for the most part, that's really been it, right? I mean, I think we'd both want the penalty kill to get a little stronger. And at times, they have been pretty passive and not done a whole lot. You know, those Ohio State games, the Ohio State game comes to mind. And but, I mean, if that's your only nitpick, is that their penalty kill needs to improve by 3 or 4 or 5 percentage points or whatever, I don't know that that's a thing where you're like, well, I don't think that we should, keep this guy.
The other thing too is the fact that based on the way they handled it, it was going to be much harder to do a national coaching search this time. The problem with when you make an interim coach and the interim coach succeeds is then you kind of get forced to keep the interim coach. Like, it's really hard then to go on the off ramp. So even if we weren't sold on Narada, it's like, kind of got to keep him.
The other thing is, like,
that's again a failing of the people that were in charge of making the decisions at the time. So the chance to do a national coaching search kind of passed. You promoted a guy. He did pretty well, and, you know,
got
to see how it goes.
Can you name 5 guys that you would want to have over Narada that you actually think would entertain the idea of coming here? Because when you start looking around, to me, like, the guys that we would say are the good coaches in college hockey, Matt Carl, Bob Motzko, Rand Pecknold, those are guys that have been well established, that have done pretty well. I don't think those guys are coming here.
I think Rand Pecknold's coming here.
Well, Pecknold might,
and I think Mike Hastings was coming here if you wanted him, because he just jumped for a
Hastings, Hastings and Pecknold, right, because of the programs they're
at. Yeah.
But they also have not ever been at a program this massive before.
Sure.
Either. But Motzko has transitioned to Minnesota and made them what they should be, and Carl has obviously had a lot of success at Denver, and they are a very, very good program. So, I mean, I don't know that either one of those guys is coming here, so now you're taking, you know, the quote-unquote mid-major coach, and you're bringing him.
I think that if you had gone back to last summer, I probably would have preferred a Hastings or a Pecknold over Narada, just because I like that safety of having a guy who's coached before.
Yeah.
And I think that coaching talent is not that hard. Like, you can figure it out. I mean, it wasn't like Mel was ripping off NHL players at Tech, and then he comes in and gets them. Like, you learn how to do that when you get to coach that kind of program.
Well, and that was a bit of the knock that you and I had on him.
So, I don't know. I don't know that Pecknold would 100% be better than Narada at Michigan. I don't know if Narada would 100% be better than Pecknold.
Right.
The part about having an interim then is that if you are in a position where you're like, oh, this guy might be better, he might not be, but we, you know. It's kind of the thing of if you're living in a house and you're looking at another house and you're like, this house is, I'm not sure it's better than our house, then why would you move? You got to pack up all your stuff to move to a place you're not sure is better. Like, when you have a guy already
and
you think that he's probably as good as the other candidates, then it's like, yeah, well, we should just keep the guy we have.
And you're not choosing between two below average. You're choosing between two guys that are probably pretty good.
Yep.
So at that point, and Narada now has ties. He's been here for 2 years now. He has recruiting, and he's started to turn, you know, the recruiting gap around a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, he's a player's coach, so that is always a plus.
Yeah, and I mean, the hires that he made and the vision that he had for the program in terms of redoing certain things, he's done pretty well there too. So there's just no I'm not really sure what the upside is of going someplace else.
I think the only worry that you'd have that you wouldn't have for Mike Hastings or Pecknold is the NHL. And that is
because you don't think they're going to the NHL.
They're old, and
you have a thing with old people, don't you?
No, I mean it's just like Brandon Nerado. If he does it 2-3 more years here at Michigan, I assume he will get an NHL offer. It's
okay,
just, will he go in that situation?
So then,
and that's the one thing you have to think about with him versus another coach.
So if he does it 2 or 3 years, and let's say he hangs a banner this year or next year or the year after, and then he leaves, and then you hire Rand Pecknold or Mike Hastings at that point, you have your banner. I don't know.
Sure.
I just don't.
I assume it won't be too long until Carl is off to the NHL too from Denver.
It's sort of like if Michigan wins 2 more games, there is a part of us that doesn't care who leaves at the end of this year. Like, you got your banner. You don't get those every year. Now, you're Michigan and you need to continue to be good, but, I mean, that's what it's all about.
At the end of the day, the Nerado thing, I'll say this. My belief is that the program should be good enough to be in the Frozen Four every year. Not be in the Frozen Four every year because that's random.
But they should be
a two seed. Should be 1 or 2 seed every year.
Yeah.
And I've seen enough to think that they can probably do that.
I would not disagree. Anything else about Nerado, or should we move on to some of the other tidbits? You brought up Mike Hastings, so where did he go?
Well, we were talking about this last week. We were wondering if Wisconsin could get a big fish.
Well, their first fish, I guess, said no?
Well, they called Carl and they called Sandlin. Which are not surprising they turned those down.
But see, that's sort of what I'm talking about, is that those are guys that, like, they're at their programs.
I mean, Scott Sandlin is Minnesota Duluth.
Right.
Like, he's
like,
not going to leave.
Like Rand Pecknold is Quinnipiac. Now, I'm not saying
he would leave.
Yeah,
he would leave, no doubt.
But they're also, it's going to take a job for them to leave.
Sure. And Wisconsin might have been that job.
Yeah, it might have been.
But Sandlin wasn't leaving because he's won national titles and he's been to Frozen Fours and he just is Minnesota Duluth hockey.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, he's also from Hibbing, Minnesota. I mean, he's like from the Iron Range.
There you go.
You know, Carl is at Denver where he's just waiting to go to the NHL. And
he's also played there.
Sure. And then beyond those two, I assume their very next call was Mike Hastings, to be honest.
You don't think they called Rolick?
They might have called Rolick. Probably did because he's an alum, but that one always seemed like an uphill battle just because you don't see coaches leave in conference. That's pretty rare.
Well, but you're starting to see coaches go in, like, in the SEC a little bit, right? Like, there's some movement around there. So, and that's essentially what the Big Ten is in college hockey, is it's kind of becoming, looking like the SEC in football.
Sure.
I mean, you just said, probably 7 of the best 10 to 15 jobs are in the Big Ten.
I think of the two options, I would take Hastings over Rolick. I think Rolick's a good coach, but Minnesota State's a tough program.
Yeah,
they don't spend nearly as much on it as Ohio State does. And for me, because I was tweeting about this was a big deal for the Big Ten and was showing them flexing their muscles, and I got a response that was like, this isn't that different than when Mel left Tech or Cromley left Northern. And I was like, no, it kind of is.
It's a much bigger deal because Mike Hastings has been really good at Minnesota State.
Right, like Cromley at Northern.
Like nationally good.
Cromley at Northern had some good years.
But he wasn't winning. He wasn't going Frozen Fours.
Right, Cromley won a national title in 1991. And then he jumped to MSU in 2002.
So you're talking about like 30 years ago. College hockey is slightly different.
No, but my point is the big difference between Cromley and Pearson leaving and Hastings is that Hastings was in a Frozen Four last year.
And was probably
Cromley went to Frozen Fours.
You picked him to win
over
it.
A decade ago, right?
Yeah.
Like, that's a big difference. And Mel hadn't been at Tech long enough. He'd only been to the tournament a couple times. That's different.
Yeah.
I mean, Hastings was in the national title game. With a lead in the national title game last season.
He was.
So
with a good team.
Yes. So to get a guy to bail out that...
I mean, he probably got some money.
It says a lot about the money. And it says even more about the money that he got his right-hand man to come with him.
So that's the next talking point, is that now we don't talk a ton about Minnesota State because they're not overly relevant to Michigan, but... That'll tell you why didn't he want it. Now, there are coaches, and this happens in every sport too. You know, obviously in football, you have coordinators that are just coordinators, but you know, you get an assistant coach that's offered a job to basically continue on what your boss had just paved the way for. And he's like, nope, I'm good. I'm going to continue riding coattails.
Yep. So Todd Knott goes with Hastings to Wisconsin, and that's a big win. I mean, he is known
for Hastings.
Yes. He's known as a really good recruiter. And now he gets to go to a place where recruiting will be way easier. So,
well, yeah, I mean, I think also that recruiting at Minnesota State's probably not hard, though. Because in that state, you're going to have a number of players.
But you have to do some evaluation. You have to do some scouting.
Yeah.
You go to Wisconsin, you slap that W on, like, you can just get guys to show up just because of the name. Tony Granato could. So...
He did. Recruiting was not Wisconsin's problem.
Like, in Minnesota State, at the end of the day, you're still number two, number three, number four in your own state.
Yeah.
Wisconsin, you're number one in that state, and you have good... You can go into...
Is there good college or high school hockey?
You can go back to Minnesota and get players. You can go into the Chicago area and get players.
That's
true. It's a national brand. It's a historic program. I mean, that's going to be... I really like that move for Wisconsin. I think it's a home run hire to get Hastings and then not to come with them.
Well, you said that the guy that you would have voted for Coach of the Year in the Big Ten might now be the least accomplished coach in the Big Ten.
He's not might. He definitely is the least accomplished. Yeah. It's a matter of if he's the worst. I don't know.
And by worst, you don't even mean anything in a negative sense. You mean just like least really good.
So you go through the Big Ten now. You have Guy Gadowski, who brought Penn State from club to D1 and has taken him to a few tournaments.
Yep.
Good coach. You have Steve Rolick at Ohio State, who's had him pretty competitive. Good coach. You have...
Played in the Frozen Four.
Jeff Jackson at Notre Dame, who's probably in his last couple years.
But he's as accomplished as there is.
One of the greats to ever coach college hockey.
Even if we can't watch his system.
And was in the Frozen Four pretty recently, too. And had been in the tournament every season until this year.
Yeah.
And then now you have Hastings, been to two Frozen Fours, 11 NCAA tournaments. Motzkow, now back-to-back Frozen Fours, a million NCAA tournaments.
And he's probably the top three in the game right now.
And then finally you have Norado, who Frozen Four in his one season. So it is a just loaded conference.
It's SEC football.
There's no other way to say it.
You know what? I like that because you don't want to have a conference where you have a Minnesota that goes 19-4-3 and then a Wisconsin that goes like what?
4-19-3
and then you have everybody else who's like fighting around it. You want 6-7 teams where if you get a sweep on a weekend, that's a big deal. And that was the case for a lot of the Big Ten, except for who was ever playing Wisconsin. And, you know, if you got a win off of Minnesota, that was a big deal. And, you know, if you can get 4 or 5 teams, there's a team that has a down year a little bit more, you know, whatever, that's fine. But if you have 5-6 teams that are all really good, similar to the Big Ten this year, and you have the title chase coming down to the final weekends, and you have a couple of one seeds the way the NCHC has had in the past, or Hockey East has had in the past, and then you have another 2 seed and maybe a 3 seed, and you have like a loaded conference, I mean, that's fun hockey. Like, that's what you want to enjoy. You don't want it to be the Big Ten where you're like, well, Michigan's going to play Ohio State in 3 months, and maybe they'll get a game out of Penn State, and the rest of them, they're just going to, like, anaconda you, and it's going to be what it is.
The Big 2, Little 8.
Right. You want to have... I mean, that's the fun about sports, right? I mean, you want to...
Yeah, it's going to be a really competitive conference. You're going to have some just brutal schedules.
Yep. And it's okay to lose games because you're playing really good teams. And that's what makes it fun. So I think that transitions us into our next point where we did bring up Rolick. So he's the pretty much only human being that is still left remaining on that Ohio State team. Well, Stephen Halliday is still there, right? But they're going to lose a number of guys to graduation and eligibility. But they lose Jacob Dobish after his sophomore year, who was really good last year. And then this past year, he was still pretty good for the most part. Maybe a tick down. They lose Mason Lowry, who was starting to be... He was probably the best skater on that team.
Yeah, he had a really good NCAA tournament. So
he was really good down the stretch. I mean, when Michigan faced him, I was very impressed with everything he did. They lose Treloar.
Yeah, so then those two signed with the NHL teams. Yep. And then in the portal, Regula, Treloar, Leslie, Maroney, and Sharameta. So five names in the portal.
And that's, I mean, Treloar was a nice player.
Yep.
I mean, would you want to take a swing at him?
Sure.
I would have taken him. He seemed to score some goals against Michigan, always found him around the net.
You can play him in your bottom six.
Yeah. Regula played a lot. I don't know that he didn't jump off the ice to me as somebody who is anything more than just a guy.
Yeah, so Maroney and Regula were both seniors. They're taking their COVID shirts
elsewhere
with them. Treloar was a junior.
Who might have a degree.
Yes.
So he could have 2 years of eligibility?
Yes. Jaden Leslie is a senior taking his COVID shirt with him. He was just a checking line guy.
Yeah.
Sharameta, also a senior who played quite a bit last two seasons, but did not really play much this season. So those are, you know, guys that are kind of filling in. But with Dobish gone, they didn't play either of their backup goalies ever. So they are going to probably be in the market for a goalie. I have to look at who they have in the portal. But it's going to be, they're probably going to take a step back. We'll see if they can get Tate Singleton back. That would be a nice guy to get back. But it's probably going to be a step back from them. They're going to have to kind of retool the roster a little bit. I would expect it to be a bit of a step back from Ohio State. Probably a step back from Minnesota next year.
Well, a step back is different than...
But they'll be a good team,
yeah.
No question about it.
I mean, they may not be a top two or three team, but they'll be probably a two seed.
Wisconsin, I think, will probably be quite a bit better because they'll still have players, and I assume that Hastings will bring in a bunch of guys.
Well, I don't know. I mean, will they lose... who's their guy that's going to get drafted?
Strammel?
Yeah.
Probably not.
He'll
stick. But they lost Kuhlmans, but whatever. I mean, they'll have some guys. I assume they'll be significantly better.
They'll also probably need to find a goalie.
Notre Dame has to figure out the goalie situation. And
they weren't the most...
No, they were bad.
...talented team.
So they're going to need to retool a little bit. If you put a gun to my head, said next season, who are the top three teams of the Big Ten? I'd say Michigan, Minnesota, and Michigan State.
Well, I would not say Ohio State, and I'd probably not say Notre Dame. And then you're down to
Penn State was
Wisconsin.
A super old team with,
and they don't have a lot of individual talent. They had
Penn State finished below in the standings than
they
Michigan State.
Sixth.
Yeah, like
they finished sixth.
They only got in the tournament because they played Sacred Heart 17 times in the non-conference. Like,
and then Wisconsin is probably going to get.
I
a
think
little
they're
going to
get better,
but
they're
probably going to
be. They're starting from behind compared to MSU.
Well, and you look,
And Michigan State's brought in four guys in the portal so far, including...
So we can transfer into that. They get the guy with the chain restaurant last name.
Yeah, Reed Lebster.
Who we remember
sounds
as an
like
old...
the Chinese version of Red Lobster.
The knockoff.
Yeah.
we saw him against UMass last year, right?
Yeah, he's just a guy to fill out a roster with. And then, I mean, Red Savage, I like. He was a draft pick. Isaac Howard is a first-rounder. Kind of flopped as a freshman, but a lot of talent. And then they brought in James Crossman, a defenseman from Brown. They'll still keep fishing the portal. I have to look at their class, but they are bringing in a borderline first-rounder and Sturback, or whatever his name is, defenseman.
Well,
and then they have Augustine as well. I mean, they are going to be a good team, I think, next year. So if you made me guess, those would be my top three teams.
Yeah, I don't think that's... I mean, this is kind of what you would expect from the Michigan State program if you were looking at a 30 or 40-year lens. You know, they kind of, since they won their national title, have not really done a lot in the last, like, 15-ish years. And... it's a bit of a curious decision making repeatedly, and now it seems like they probably got a pretty good to decent to good coach, I would say, and they're starting to fill out their roster. They're getting a little bit more talent, and I mean, you know, they let Drew DeRitter go, and we're like, well, what are you gonna do? And he ends up being bad, right? And then they get St. Cyr, who plays, I think, good enough to keep them in a ton of games, and they'll build. They're starting to build back what you would want from a Michigan State
program. Read that list. They're a top 10 team in money spent on their program. They should not be bad.
That's true.
Conley in steep decline those last three seasons, and then they move on from him and proceed to spend 10 years between two guys that were completely and totally incompetent. And that kind of got them where they're at. And then they get a guy in who seems to be competent.
Yep.
And that does a lot, it turns out.
Yep. That makes a lot of sense. So you wanted to also talk a little bit about a rule that passed in one of the Canadian junior leagues.
The QMJHL is banning fighting. And I thought this was an interesting thing to talk about.
So this is the Quebec
to fill some time
major junior
college hockey.
I mean, we're almost at 80 minutes, I think. I think we're okay.
But we're balancing the segment length.
We need to have it be 50 minutes because the first one was. So, but that's an interesting talking point because, you know, we've had discussions in the NHL about fighting. I'm not as against fighting as some people are. My thing was more like the post-whistle stuff that I think is trash, but that's apparently part of hockey culture. The fighting thing, you say, that keeps cheap shots out of the game.
To some degree, but I think there's also a strong case that there were also a lot more cheap shots in an era where there was a lot of fighting, too. That
okay.
Hockey was just inherently more violent in that era in general. It's an interesting thing because, you know, the Canadian Junior Leagues often were always significantly more violent with often a very strong culture of fighting, and college hockey never had that. You know, never had it even from its very beginning.
Yeah.
So that was always an interesting kind of divide, and now we're seeing some of the CHL leagues start to gravitate towards that a little bit. The interesting thing was when the QMJHL said they were banning fighting, originally they were like, well, we're banning fighting, but we don't really know how yet. So
we don't know how. What?
We'll get back to you later when we come up with a plan of how to ban it. But we're banning it.
You just ban it? What I don't understand.
Well, what do you do if someone fights? When you say we're banning fighting, you can't just say that.
What would the Big Ten do if like Keaton Pearson and
there's a protocol. They get suspended. There's a way to handle that.
So that's how.
Right, but they didn't say how they were going to do it. They just said we're doing it, and we'll tell you the plan.
So we didn't. Okay, so they didn't announce what the
plan was originally.
The consequences.
Yeah, a QMJHL spokesperson said Wednesday morning that no punishment has been decided yet, but they're considering several options.
What are the options?
I think it's going to end up being probably several game suspensions. Probably most likely,
okay.
As the punishment.
Sure, that makes sense.
They are the league that has been cracking down the most in the CHL on it. They added a 10-minute misconduct for fighting back in 2020, and now they're taking it another step further, which is definitely interesting. I think it's just kind of the way it's going in a lot of ways, that fighting in the NHL has dropped from 0.44 to 0.25 fights per game since 2011 to 2012.
Well, we're not.
And over that same period, the QMJHL had fights drop from 0.78 to 0.07. So you've already seen in this particular league, fighting was vanishing anyway. And over that same period, it's been in the NHL to some degree.
So I have a question then. Let's say the other CHL team leagues also ban fighting, and it's obviously not allowed in college. How can it still be legal in the NHL at that point? Like, after a certain period of time, all the players who grew up playing, I mean, I guess you could bring in, like, you know, the Europeans or something, who are clearly known for their fighting, that you then play hockey where you cannot fight, and then you finally get to your professional end-of-the-road league, and now you can fight?
So that's probably what it will be, yes.
Is that eventually
it will be like that? That then when you get in the NHL, then you can fight. And so the Athletic.
So it's like when you're 25, then you can rent a car?
The Athletic has been doing a good series of pieces on the history of fighting in the NHL and interviewing a lot of people.
Have you been reading them?
Yeah, they've been good pieces.
Okay.
They've been interviewing people who were once the great fighters and talking about how it unfolded and everything. And I think what you're seeing in a lot of ways is that, you know, they basically want in the junior leagues, because the junior leagues start when you are children.
Yeah.
That the parents, and there's just this belief that we don't want the children fighting. And then if they get in a pro league as adults and they want to make that decision, knowing the risks, knowing everything else, then they can fight.
Yeah, but you don't know how to fight. You're not used to that. I mean, now all of a sudden you're in a league and you got to figure it out. Also, you're not really going to have players who really fight. Like, I mean, how many Milan Lucic's are there anymore? Or who's the Delorier? You know what I mean? Like, those guys aren't going to play. They can't play enough hockey. Their job is to fight.
And those guys, by the way, would be toast in another era. Like, the guys we think now as the tough guys are not tough.
Ryan Reeves?
Yeah, Ryan Reeves. He would be a middleweight in the old days.
Because he wasn't big enough?
Yeah, I mean, the old days, there were real fighters in those days.
Okay, but did they also play hockey?
But that represents the natural progression of kind of where this has gone. And I don't think the NHL will ever ban fighting. I think it will always be a part of the game. But it will be a lot like what it is right now, which
maybe.
Is that it pops up here and there. It pops up.
What if we have a rule that you can only have goalie fights?
I would be fine with that. But there's a
what
lot.
What if you have a mandated goalie fights? So that it has to happen. You have to have one of your goalies fight once a week.
Goalie fights are very enjoyable.
Were you very?
That's what
were
I'll
you
say.
Disappointed when they broke up Fleury and Binnington? Did you hear the audio of Fleury talking during the fight? I thought that was the best. The fans will love it. That was my favorite thing. It would be good for the game, huh?
The one interesting thing about fighting in the NHL this season is that the Lightning, the team that we all think is one of the class of the NHL, all that, they've gone like all in on fighting this year. I watched a lot of the Lightning games. They fight all the time.
Well, they don't have...
way more than any other team I watch.
They're starting to lose
They traded for Tanner Jeannot, who's a fighter. And they already have Maroon, and like it just happens a lot when I watch their games relative.
But they
to,
have to play these like sort of more low event games, right? Like they don't have the depth of scoring that they used to, and
sure.
They're kind of on their last legs of like the Hedmans and the Stamkos types, right? Like they got a few years left for sure, but they're not. I mean, they're not remotely the best team in that division.
No,
so. Could they make a run?
But yeah, I mean, also, I think that where we're at in the NHL does speak to that in the sense that the Lightning fight and the Bruins still have a few guys that fight. And I think there will always be a couple guys that add that component to their game. But you have to have the rest of the game, right?
Right.
That's the whole thing about Tanner Jeannot. It's like, okay, he's a fighter, but he's not a Rob Ray fighter. He's not a 2-3-5, 400 penalty minute guy, right? Like Tanner Jeannot is a player. But I think there will always be the niche for players to say, okay, I'm a third, fourth line guy. How can I add something to my value?
Yeah.
Well, I can fight a little bit, and then that will give me a few, a couple extra million on my salary.
But you don't have the heavyweight slobber knockers that you
have. And that era of heavyweight fighters is never coming back.
Do you miss it? Do you wish it would?
Not really. I mean, the fight night at the Joe, that was as good as it got in terms of fighting. And what was great about that was it wasn't really a lot of enforcers. It was guys that were really, really great.
But that's not the fun.
Too.
But nobody wants to watch those guys fight. People want to watch the big goons, right? I mean, that's who you want to see fight.
It's just a culture of the game that has vanished.
I mean, not that I need to see anyone fight, to be honest. When you go to a wrestling match, as I know you attend a lot, like you want to watch Mason Parrish, right? Like the big guys.
Well,
you don't want to watch the two little bugs that are just like wrapping around each other, rolling on the ground.
So the thing is that when you have stars fighting, it can be fun because it's stars that are fighting.
Well,
but there was a whole subculture in the old days of everyone knew who the heavyweights were. They knew who the great fighters were. They knew the fight card, who you fought, what your record is. Like it was.
Did they print a fight card next to the lineup card?
It was a huge part of the game.
And just tape it on
like,
the glass.
If you go back in time, that was as much of the game as the game was knowing who the fighters were. And that element of hockey's never coming back. And I think it's fine. I think that it's just interesting to see how it's happening. And they did this series in conjunction with the QMJHL decision. And, we're seeing a little bit of college hockey taking over, I guess, is the way I would put it. The one thing I'd recommend for people is that the series, they've had some interesting things interviewing people and kind of getting the psychological side of it, of sort of knowing, like, okay, I'm putting on the skates. Like, tonight I'm going to be punched in the face, like, several times. Like what that psychologically did to guys. It's very interesting. I'd recommend checking it out if you have an athletic subscription. But
all right. Well, it does not sound like we will be seeing any fights this weekend, and probably not next year on the coverage of this podcast, as that is not what college hockey is about. And it sounds like Canadian juniors is slowly going that way as well. So do you have anything else to add before we hold our breath for the next 5 days, hoping that Michigan can pull out a couple of 50-50 games?
One thing I'll say is I'm happy that we actually have playoff races this year, the final 2 weeks of the NHL season. But we didn't have playoff races last year, and that's fun.
So. Down the stretch. Well, I mean, we'll still have them next week, right? We can talk about that potentially next week, or depending on how
sure,
many
Sure, I mean,
games
this is just a general point. It's like you get to the end of the season, and it's like last year there was just nothing to talk about.
Well,
really.
The Flames tried to stay out of it, but the Jets wouldn't let them. Right?
Well, the Jets and the Flames play this week. I think the Panthers and the Sabres play this week. There's actually fun, enticing games with playoff implications.
So if you're interested in watching the 8th and 9th best teams in the conference play each other, there you go.
Thank you for listening to Michigan Hockey Cast 5.23 for Alex Drain and David Nasternak. Come back next week where we will either be celebrating or crying. Find out which.